Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Archeries Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. A Bubble That Broke the World is a nonfiction collection by American journalist Garrett Garrett, first published in 1932 and later reissued in various editions. The book gathers a series of contemporary essays originally written for the Saturday Evening Post during the early years of the Great Depression. Its purpose is not to tell a personal story or offer abstract theory, but to explain why the 1929 stock market crash and the economic collapse that followed had happened. Garrett argues from a distinctly skeptical, libertarian perspective, placing major responsibility on wartime debt, foreign lending, credit expansion, and monetary distortion rather than on capitalism itself. As a historical document, the book is valuable because it captures how a sharp observer of finance understood the crisis while it was still unfolding. As an economic argument, it challenges simpler retrospective narratives and insists that policy choices helped build the conditions for disaster. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, how wartime credit and foreign debt helped inflate the boom. Garrett's central explanation is that the post-World War I financial environment was unstable because the United States extended large amounts of credit abroad, especially to European governments struggling with war debt and reconstruction. He treats this lending as more than a diplomatic issue. In his view, the money did not consistently flow into productive, wealth-building investment. Instead, it often supported public spending, debt rollover, and currency stabilization, all of which could sustain activity without creating a durable economic base. That distinction matters because the book argues that a boom built on borrowed money is structurally fragile. Garrett sees the bubble as international in scope, not just domestic speculation on Wall Street, by linking American credit policy to later financial weakness. He presents the crash as the delayed result of decisions made during and after the war, rather than as a sudden and mysterious market failure. Secondly, the Federal Reserve as an enabler of artificial expansion. Another major theme is Garrett's criticism of the Federal Reserve and the broader machinery of credit creation. He does not present monetary policy as a neutral background factor. Instead, he argues that easy credit and monetary expansion help produce distortions in the structure of production, encouraging activity that could not be sustained once conditions normalized. In this reading, the central bank did not simply respond to prosperity. It helped intensify it past healthy limits. That makes the eventual correction unavoidable. Garrett's argument is important because it shifts attention from moral blame to systemic incentives. The problem is not merely that individuals speculated too much, but that policy made leverage easier and corrections harder to absorb. He treats the central bank as a force that can disguise scarcity, postpone necessary adjustment, and deepen the eventual collapse when reality reasserts itself. Thirdly, a critique of the idea that capitalism itself caused the depression. Garrett writes against the common assumption that the crash and the depression were proof that capitalism had failed. His essays instead suggest that the crisis came from intervention, manipulation, and accumulated debt, not from free exchange or market coordination in their pure form. This is one of the book's defining intellectual positions. He is less interested in defending every market outcome than in identifying the difference between genuine market prices and prices distorted by credit policy. That distinction allows him to argue that the crash was not a verdict on capitalism, but a correction after years of institutional distortion. The book therefore functions as both explanation and rebuttal. It challenges readers to separate market excess from market principle, and to see how public policy can create the conditions in which private speculation becomes widespread and dangerous. Fourthly, the crash as a necessary correction rather than a solvable emergency. A striking feature of Garrett's analysis is his acceptance of correction as unavoidable. He does not treat the collapse as a problem that can simply be managed away with more intervention. Instead, he argues that the earlier inflation of credit and debt had already created imbalances that had to be worked out somehow. If the system had been pushed beyond its real productive capacity, then the painful adjustment was not an accident, but a delayed consequence. This view gives the book a hard-edged realism that distinguishes it from policy-focused histories that mainly ask what officials should have done next. Garrett's answer is more austere: let the correction happen and learn from it. Whether a reader agrees or not, the argument is intellectually important because it confronts the trade-off between short-term stabilization and long-term structural health. He implies that attempts to avoid pain can sometimes prolong it. Lastly, why the book still matters as a contemporary warning about debt and bubbles. Although the essays were written in the early 1930s, their relevance comes from how directly they anticipate a recurring financial behavior. Garrett's discussion of debt expansion, fiat money, easy credit, and speculative excess gives the book a lasting place in economic history. It is not a technical manual and does not attempt modern quantitative modeling. Its strength lies in historical diagnosis, and in the clarity of its warning that bubbles tend to repeat when institutions reward leverage and postpone discipline. The book therefore remains useful for readers who want to understand not only the Great Depression, but also the recurring language of financial excess in later eras. Its enduring value is partly rhetorical. Garrett writes as a journalist with a sharp sense of public consequence, so the essays combine explanation with urgency. That makes the book stand out from conventional histories that are more detached or more focused on later political responses. In conclusion, A Bubble That Broke the World should be read by anyone interested in the Great Depression, monetary history, central banking, or the political economy of debt. It is especially useful for students and general readers who want a period source that explains the crisis from inside the era rather than through later academic reconstruction. The book rewards readers who want to compare competing interpretations of the 1929 crash, because Garrett offers a strong, clearly stated alternative to the idea that the Depression was simply a failure of capitalism. Its practical value lies in the way it sharpens attention to credit expansion, leverage, and the long consequences of policy decisions that appear temporary at the time. What makes it stand out among similar books is its combination of journalistic immediacy and economic argument. Garrett writes as a contemporary witness with a forceful thesis, so the book feels both historically grounded and intellectually provocative. Even readers who disagree with his conclusions will likely find that it improves their understanding of how bubbles form, why they persist, and why their aftermath is so difficult to manage. If you would like to support Garrett Garrett, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.